I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. The distinguished writer Donal Mengistu joins me now. The acclaimed writer has just published his third novel, which, like his previous two, has received outstanding notices. All Our Names is the story of a young man who views the African Revolution after the end of colonialism and the independence of Uganda up close, and who goes to America in a Midwest town, taking up with a social worker he's assigned who happens to be of a different color. That relationship and friendship he had with a charismatic leader who inspired him in Kampala are the core of this book, and I'll get Mr. Mengistu to tell us about the book and the struggle for identity that these characters encounter throughout. Donal Mengistu is an award-winning author of two previous novels, The Beautiful Things That Heaven Bears and How to Read the Air. He is a 2012 MacArthur Foundation Genius Grant recipient and has countless other accolades. All Our Names is published by Bond Street Books, which is an imprint of Random House. Please welcome to the Plant on the Line program in Toronto today, Donal Mengistu. Professor Mengistu, good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
I understand you live in New York?
Correct. I live in New York now.
But we also teach at Georgetown, is that right?
Yes. I lived in Paris for the past 5 years. And then moved to New York, returned back to New York about 2 years ago, and now teach at Georgetown, so it's a bit of a strange multiple layers of living.
Yeah, so I read somewhere that you teach one day a week, is that right?
Correct.
Yeah, so do you have to commute then, or?
Yeah, I take a very early morning train on Tuesdays, and if at all possible, take a very late train back home, since I have two little kids, and it's nice to try to be there when they wake up the next day.
So I understand now that you're on this book tour promoting this book. I read somewhere that you've gone to something like 9 cities, I think.
Oh, I think counting Canada now, I think we're probably at 11 or 12.
Yeah. It involves obviously a lot of travel. Do you find that there's something enjoyable in these long book tours?
To be honest, no. The enjoyable part is it is always really a pleasure to actually meet your readers.
Mm-hmm.
So that part's actually really great. Once you're actually in the event, once you're actually sort of having a conversation with people, that's always really, really lovely and reminds and affirms why you sort of do this very strange solitary thing. At the same time, you know, the sort of the displacement on a day-to-day basis is a bit tiring, and there is always something a bit strange about the fact that, you know, as a writer you tend to work in solitude most of the time, and then suddenly that solitude is you know really taken away from you very quickly, and then suddenly you this thing you've been working on for 5 years in your head now has to take on a public life that you always knew was going to happen, but you know it does take a little bit of easing into that public role again.
Now, you mentioned that you get to meet readers along the way. Do you get a sense of who they are? Like, I mean, this may seem like a silly question, but I mean, do you have very many immigrant readers, say?
I have some, I would say, but you know, it's probably nor nearly as much as you would like. You know, there are always definitely. I always encounter immigrants without a doubt at every event that I do, not just from Ethiopia, but really from all over the world,
mm-hmm.
and even people who have sort of emigrated, you know, two generations ago will still oftentimes introduce themselves to me as saying, you know, they feel like immigrants because their parents felt like immigrants or their grandparents felt like immigrants or were immigrants, in fact. But, you know, but then also by and large, you know, we most of our readers do tend to sort of be fairly affluent, upper middle class and college educated, which immigrants are, of course, all of those things as well, but just not in the same, you know, they're not, we don't, there aren't as many immigrants, of course, as there are other segments of the population.
But this is a book, from what I've read. I've unfortunately only read a bit of it. There's something universal here. And I'm curious to know, was that what you wanted to... I mean, you're always labeled as a writer of, say, the immigrant experience, but you're obviously more than that. But there is something here that's universal in terms of something that all people can relate to.
Yeah, of course. You know, I think that's always been the intent of every writer. I mean, it seems to be the thing that makes literature is that it's you ground the stories in as much specificity as you feel is necessary, but always with the hope that any reader, doesn't matter where they come from, where they live, the color of their skin, their faith, their ethnicity, that they can sort of step into these stories. part of themselves in these characters. So that's always, you know, if that wasn't the case, then it would be a very sort of hard thing to want to spend that much time writing a novel if you didn't feel like it had a kind of universal element to it. And of course, the universality is only derives from how well these characters are constructed, like how plausible their humanity is when people, you know, meet and get to know other human beings. You know, you stop thinking of them as purely products of a certain class or of a certain race. You think of them as somebody who you know and care about, and hopefully the fictional characters you create have that same level of veracity.
And so in terms of, as the person who creates these characters, in terms of where they come from, was there something you wanted to say about who they were?
We're trying to make sure when I'm writing that I'm never trying to dictate the terms of my characters. You know, I think you approach your characters with the idea that they are these, you know, slightly mysterious ideas in your head, and as you're writing them into existence, you're beginning to grapple with all the sort of contradictory and complex emotions that have made them who they are. And so you're always hopefully you're saying, you're never saying one thing about them. You know, I think the idea is just try to show them as these sort of oftentimes difficult, sometimes wonderful, sometimes awful human beings who are capable of great things, and also at the same time capable of doing very awful things to one another.
So let's set up these characters in the book. I mean, we have, I guess, two guys who go to Kampala for an education. And one guy's a narrator, and then the other guy is the guy who ends up being the revolutionary, right?
Correct.
Yeah. They're both named Isaac?
That becomes the sort of very hard part about how to sort of how to talk about this novel without giving away too much of the sort of plot. And then there's a very specific reason for that. You know, the characters in the novel are definitely shedding their names throughout the whole novel from the very beginning, and they're taking on new names. And the narrator of one half of the novel is very much a slightly enigmatic character himself, in that his identity isn't the same one at the beginning of the novel as it is at the end. And you know, he has this very close friend named Isaac, who gives him his name eventually. And the process of him giving him that name is really what forms their, or sort of, you know, the trajectory of their relationship.
So what is the Uganda that they go to, I guess, in Kampala? What does that look like? And I guess that would be in the 60s, right?
It'd be the early 1970s, because the story is taking place almost a decade after independence, and so Uganda became independent in 1962. And, you know, it is very much, of course, a fictional version of Uganda, and it's a version of Uganda that it lives through the eyes of one specific character. You know, the narrator comes to Uganda at that time because he's you know, read about this great literary conference that actually did happen in 1962 that brought together some of the leading that brought together what we now know to be, you know, some of the most seminal figures in African literature, including the Gugi wa Thiong'o and Chinua Achebe and Willy Sank, I believe. And so this conference is the sort of, for the narrator, serves as the sort of romantic ideal of what is possible in a city like Kampala, what's possible in a newly independent country like Uganda. And so for him, this capital, this country, the city, they're all seen through the haze and through the sort of romantic gaze of someone who imagines this as a place that's full of sort of an intellectual and political vibrancy. And to some degree, he finds this college campus full of young, aspiring revolutionary figures.
And he wants to be a writer himself?
Yeah, and he himself wants to be a writer. So, you know, his desire to sort of go to Uganda or go to Kampala is sort of predicated on this, you know, and he's not really sure, I think, what that means. You know, he knows that he doesn't want to sort of do the same thing that his father did. He doesn't want to stay in the same small village. He doesn't want to sort of continue the same agrarian tradition. He wants something different. And so he latches onto this idea of becoming a writer because he read about it. Whether or not the sort of sincerity of that intent is of course up to the reader to decide to some degree, and it's really also for the character, his own evolution is slightly predicated on coming to the terms with how sincere he really is in that intent and that desire. But that is what brings him to Kampala initially, is that feeling that here's a place where he actually can become a writer.
And then, so what brings him to America?
And what gets him to America is the realization that he's not going to get to be a writer to some degree. You know, it's the It's the fact that all those, some of those hopes and ambitions are not only for him, but for lots of young men like him who imagined, you know, the sort of era of post-colonialism would usher in a sort of bright future. And instead, a lot of that future was sort of warped or sort of damaged by the transformation of these, you know, sort of independent leaders into tyrants and into autocrats. And so that spurs on the sort of second wave of violence. The first one was sort of removal of the colonial powers. Then the second one comes, what happens when these governments start turning against themselves and start turning against their own population? So it's that revolutionary movement and the violence that follows it that forces him to America.
And then when he gets to America, he meets Helen. I guess she's a social worker that he's assigned. It's a Midwest town, right?
Yes, exactly. It's called Laurel, and it's definitely a loosely fictionalized version of several different Midwestern towns that I've known and have grown up in over the course of my childhood.
Well, what do you find that Helen's looking for in life?
I've always thought of her as being very closely related to Isaac. You know, that she comes. She's been, unlike him, you know, she's been very much deeply rooted in this one particular town and this one particular community. And yet, despite that, she doesn't necessarily feel completely at home there. You know, she's an American woman, but she's also an American woman who chooses not to do the sort of normal things that an American woman would have done in the early 1970s. She tries to have a career rather than just get married and have a family. She has a very sort of strong, independent voice that I think she always feels needs to be tempered or dampened down. And so when she meets Isaac, I think she meets somebody who reminds her that there is this sort of possible greater world out there. And so part of her fascination with him is the fact that, she actually feels kind of less alone with him, even though he is such a stranger to her, that with him she can sort of be more of herself than she gets to be with anybody else. She can shout as loud as she wants, and she knows that Isaac's not going to reject her for that.
And then they soon begin a relationship that's more than, say, the social worker-client relationship.
Exactly. And their relationship evolves really quickly, and some of it is initially superficial. You know, I think they go through the gestures of a normal couple before they actually become a couple. You know, she's guiding him through the Midwest. She's guiding him through the grocery store. She helps him buy furniture. She teaches him how to cook. So they spend all this time doing these domestic activities, and it's the process of doing that leads their relationship to begin. And then over the course of the relationship, what they need to do is actually find something more stable, more meaningful than just that to hold on to.
Where it's set in the I guess as you said, in the early 70s. I mean, this is the post civil rights era,
correct.
And so this adds a different sort of tension, because this is not the South.
No.
And where a relationship like that of Helen's and Isaac's would be, you know, treated with hostility, but there is this tension there, and this is what fascinates me, as to why you perhaps pick the Midwest, why you pick this era to put them in.
Part of the reason why I chose that particular time period in the U.S. is because it also seems to me to echo some of what was happening in Africa at the same time. You know, the civil rights movement. You know, 1963, the March on Washington was took place the same year that Kenya became independent. So you had the sense of sort of liberation movements happening on two different continents and across multiple countries. And you know, in Africa, that liberation movement was eventually sort of hobbled by the sort of rise in tyranny and the sort of frustration of realizing that some of these governments weren't going to fulfill their promises. And then something sort of similar happened in the U.S., or at least in my imagination, that, you know, after the Civil Rights Movement and all the sort of legislative gains that were achieved through it, 1968, Martin Luther King was assassinated, as was Robert Kennedy, and you had the sort of riots that followed. And so even though the Civil Rights Movement achieved a lot, there is still a profound economic disparity that existed and still persists between African Americans and white Americans. And the riots were more sort of a dramatic representation of that. And so even though also we were able to do legislative gains, communities still remain deeply divided, and you can still find that, and not putting it in the South, in the early 1970s, in certain communities, a black woman or white woman and a black man still would have just been almost unfathomable. You know, there was a famous court case, Love versus the State of Virginia.
Loving, yeah.
Which had to pass in the 1960s in order to sort of ban miscegenation laws.
Mm.
So, you know, America made great progress, but when you begin to take that progress and you look at it on the sort of most intimate relationship possible that happens in a couple, you see how those biases and those prejudices persist.
Now, you've also done in your career a lot of reporting about Africa, traveled there, I'm sure. Did that feed into your process of understanding Africa for this book?
Oh, definitely. Yeah, there's there are lots of images, lots of little small details that I witnessed as a journalist. That some of which made their way into the actual stories that I wrote, but lots of it were also the sort of impressions that never had a proper place in an article, or they were sentiments, experiences that sort of have lingered with me that I knew. Or that I didn't know, but eventually, found a way of working themselves into my fiction. Some of it's very sort of small, pragmatic details, like there's a hotel where these group of young revolutionary men are garrisoned in this village, and that hotel is very, very much based on this hotel that I spent time in Eastern Congo. Joseph, who is the leader of this revolutionary movement in the novel, shares certain strong traits with a colonel in the Congolese army that I spent time with as well.
So I'm sure on this grueling book tour that you're on, you were asked about how much of your own experience you draw upon for writing your novels. Did you think there'll come a time when you won't be asked that?
Probably not. I think almost all novels are asked that question. And there's always parts of you. In many ways, this novel is so far removed from my own life. It's very easy to point out the ways in which it can't be autobiographical. I wasn't even born when most of the storyline
yeah.
takes place. I never lived in Kampala. I never sort of went through these revolutionary movements. I've never been a white woman in the Midwest. So it's very easy to point out the large differences. But of course, at the same time, even within those differences, there's always pieces of you spread out throughout the whole narrative. You can't. Possible to deny that there's always impressions that you've had, people that you've known who worked their way into the text, but of course you're radically distorting them as a novelist. Those little fragments are sort of jumping off points for your imagination.
And then there's also, I'm assuming, the burden that people foist upon you in terms of chronicling Africa, chronicling the immigrant experience. I mean, is that something that you feel when writing, say?
It's something that you know is in the back of your head. From my first novel on, I was worried to make sure, I'm always very careful to make sure that I feel like I'm representing my characters, especially my African characters, with as much complexity as possible, and especially if those characters are trapped in violent situations. It's very important to me to make sure that the violence doesn't sound like a cliche, or that the violence doesn't sound like the sort of familiar news articles that we often read that make violence in Africa seem like it's part of some, endless process of ethnic hatred, when in fact it almost never is that. So, that impetus to make sure that I choose my words and my structure very carefully is incredibly important, and I'm glad that it's there, actually.
Yeah. Was there something you wanted to say, though, about America and the time period that's depicted in the book?
You use the past always as a way of trying to talk about the present, so it was never really just even about trying to capture what was America was like in the 1970s, but still very much the ways in which, it still feels like to me now, writing the novel, most of the novel was written in France, and so even though some of the forms of discrimination may not be so evident, there's still a persistent problem in our society. And at the same time, there's also a lot of wonderful things that I love about America that I hope are also evident in the novel, including the fact that a character like Isaac can come to this sort of small town in the Midwest and start making a life out of for himself eventually with the help of Helen. I think that's a pretty remarkable thing that he can do. So it's important to recognize that side as well.
You gave an interview to the Chicago Tribune that I found fascinating, because they asked you about your identity, and you were quite clear that it's usually shaped by how people perceive you. So
yeah.
That if you're in America, you're thought of as black or African American or an immigrant from Ethiopia. If you're in Ethiopia, you're probably considered more American than anything else. What do you feel, though? I mean, are you at a point where how people think of you as, or how you're perceived, does that matter still?
No, it doesn't. It doesn't. I mean, it to me matters only in the sense that I feel that I'm able to inhabit all these places at the same time. So, I feel like I'm very much. I know the experience of being black in America, and it's something that's very important to who I am. I also feel very Ethiopian. I also feel very American. I also feel, all of these things. And so, oftentimes, my only frustration is when people want me to sort of pretend as if I have to choose only one thing to be. That I always find a bit silly. I think we have the right to inhabit as many different layers as we need to, because our lives are more complex than a single narrative or a single identity. We all have multiple influences, multiple sources that inspire us, that shape us. So when somebody, wants a perspective from the African immigrant, and it's something, if it feel like it's something that I actually know, then I do feel like that's an honest reflection of who I am. If somebody wants to, why I lived in France, people oftentimes would ask questions that would be like, tell us about Barack Obama, and then in the next sentence tell us about Ethiopia, and then in the next sentence tell us about racism in America, and tell us about racism in Europe. And you realize that they were just, they were using you to try to figure out many different things for themselves, and that's okay with me now.
Now, growing up, did you always want to be a writer?
Yeah, from a fairly early age, I'd say. Definitely by the time I began college, I knew literature was sort of very central to my identity, who I was. And I began, writing really seriously by my freshman year in college. But even prior to that, I'd say by high school, I was spending most of my time with books and making my first attempts at storytelling.
Is the life, the career that you have now, is that one that you could have imagined that you would have wanted, say, growing up?
I think I probably have been more fortunate than I would have ever dared to imagine. I feel very lucky. You hope to have you really just at the beginning actually just hope that you have a book published. That's actually the very beginning and oftentimes the only thing that you really imagine. So everything after that is just an extra bonus.
And so you're promoting this book now, but I'm sure you're asked what the next book will be. Are you working on something now?
That's the great thing now, is I can actually say no. I actually have very little. It's been all three books have come one immediately after the other, and I've always been working on something for a very long time now. So at this point, I'm happy to sort of pause for a little bit and think about where I will go next as a writer.
It's been such a pleasure talking to you today. Continued good luck with this book.
Thank you very much.
The book is called All Our Names. It's from Bond Street Books, which is an imprint of Random House. Its author, Dinao Mengistu. Join me on the line from Toronto and Vancouver. I'm Joseph Plata.